Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, welcome to our edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. And if this is your first episode with us on the podcast, welcome. Appreciate you listening in. And for those many that are returning for more episodes and more discussions, also welcome. And especially welcome to those that have contributed some questions and comments. And if nothing else, just the virtual applause. We hear from folks at conferences and at meetings and randomly through email and reviews. And so we really appreciate your support. So Adam, I know that every now and then we hear something from audience, and you're always doing something strange to equipment. I'm not sure what you've got in mind today.
I think you're gonna like this one. This one is me flying a 1953 T-34 Air Force plane, and I did not crash it, which is
this is
awesome.
Like in real life.
Flying? In real life. This is in okay. real life, yeah.
You didn't just
yeah.
steal it off the tarmac, did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't. It's a friend's that it has finished going through a thorough restoration okay. Like 20 years ago. Very amateur. I've mostly since then been crashing radio control planes. And so he did the takeoff and landing. But once we were up there, I had it. And it was a lot of fun. But it was interesting talking a lot about the restoration as well. And for those who aren't familiar with what this kind of plane is it's a two-seater prop plane. It was used in the Air Force for training pilots, everything from basic flying to actual dogfighting. So it has some pretty good acrobatic capabilities as well. It can pull up to 5 Gs. So like for regular civilians, that's like blackout kind of Gs. So it's quite a cool plane.
Oh, that's cool. So, I'm interested in the restoration parts because it's, I mean, how old is the fuselage, would you imagine?
1953.
You did mention it. So,
yep.
So, 65 years old at this point?
Yep. Yeah. And the thing with aluminum is it's interesting, right? Because it doesn't oxidize in a way where the material, is lost, right? It oxidizes, creates a ceramic coating on itself.
Right. But that protects it, right?
Right, but aluminum also can, in certain conditions, you can lose material, and sometimes it'll do it inside, and you don't notice it till you touch it, right?
So
it
has that. Or you take off.
Right, exactly. Then you don't just notice it; everybody does. And so it's very interesting to talk about it. But one of the things that was interesting that really interested me was the change in, approach to design and some of the things when you do a restoration that you take advantage of, technology, changes. And, one of them that was interesting was talking about some of the engine differences because it's a Teledyne Continental motor. It was kind of interesting to talk about how, because a motor is everything in an airplane as far as, a significant safety, piece of equipment compared to a car where you pull over in an airplane, you have to find a place to land. Within your glide path, your glide distance, which may or may not be a good landing spot. So it's kind of interesting all the little things that are different now that either ensure, that the reliability, but also kind of prognostically can tell you in advance, far in advance of taking off if something is degrading, kind of degradation model kind of stuff. So I found that really neat.
You're going to have to dive into some specifics here because you're going all over the map now.
I know.
There's like 15 newer episodes on just this.
I'm getting there.
All right.
So for those of us, as you said, for those of you who are new to this series, Fred and I like to argue with each other. For those of you who have heard us before, get ready for it. So what's kind of neat is that with the engine with the heads, the different design and the heads and the carburetors, because with having such dramatic atmospheric and temperature changes, you can have freezing in the carburetors and you can also have flow problems in the heads. Mm-hmm. That, of course, over 60 years of continuing, pilots and aeronautical engineers continue to work with it, they found ways to optimize it, improve it, and reduce those events down to almost nothing. Where historically that would have been a major concern. It would have been something they taught them a lot about back then, mm-hmm. as they were training the pilots. And now is really not a concern. And I think that one of the ones that really fascinated me was the wing spars. So the wing spar is basically the spine of the wing, you know, going out from the fuselage out to the tip, and the rest of the wing is built right off of it. And what was interesting is that, you know, so this plane's able to pull some extremely high Gs, and it's rated for 5G, so it has, but it has margin above that. Now, not too far in a distant past, a lot of these retired planes were being used by kind of just consumer schools, right? And one of them was a high-performance school where people would learn to dogfight. You could go up there and dogfight with your friends if you were a very advanced pilot.
Right.
And they had some issues, actually, with the wing spars cracking. And it was because these guys were getting so into it, they were pulling way beyond the, you know, specified specified value of 5Gs, to where they, so the plane was not failing its design specification. It was that these people obviously were not professional Air Force pilots, so they weren't keeping an eye on that and getting overexcited.
But you're
so
talking you're talking about cracking, and this is a aluminum and pretty beefy attachments, yeah, and methods, but it's not the wing didn't fall off. You're talking about cracks where it's an accumulated damage. What I'm trying to get at is it goes beyond the elastic region for that particular design and material set, right?
Exactly. So start getting cracks. Yeah, exactly. The cracks propagate far enough that it doesn't have the structural strength that it's supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this made me think of is, you know, how we expect our customers to use our products. You know, we want them to do it within specifications, but if you don't actually lock them out from going beyond it, you're still accountable, right? So the FAA actually had to do a huge investigation, even though this design was from, you know, 50 years earlier at that time.
Right.
They still did a huge investigation into the design and the manufacturer. So here is this manufacturer, Beechcraft, being held accountable half a century later after production for design.
Of amateur pilots just going at it.
Right, a bunch of hotshots. Yeah, exactly. Who, you know, thought they were fighter pilots, and it came down entirely to how do you control your, you know, the user from using the product within specification. I think that's a challenge with a lot of manufacturers and people I work with as well.
Well, I was working with a medical device product, and their problem was the technician and the surgeon. The cable was too short, so they would just pull it off the counter. It would crash to the floor, and they like, well, put it closer. Well, they can't because of all the other activities and so on. And so their solution was, we got to do this now. So they yank it, and it crashed. And they were technically unable to lengthen the cable. There were a variety of reasons for that. And so it's not getting the adoption it wanted to. And it says, well, and there were lamenting that, well, it's in the manual, it's in the training, it's in this cable is not a pole. It doesn't move the product. It doesn't extract any more cable out of it. You don't do that. And if it falls on the floor, it's bad. And no amount of that worked. They needed to create a product that fit within that realm if they wanted to be in that market. And that's kind of an extreme case of where the customer is going to use it the way they want to use it, and you'd better adapt to that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but looking back 65 years, there's no way that, you know, Beechcraft, right, or anybody else could force. But I've also heard of that concept of foreseeable misuse, and I think that's what you alluded to briefly, is that, you know, if they misuse it and come back to you because somebody got hurt or killed, then, yeah, the design is typically, it's not always, but typically, it's even for foreseeable misuse that a design team can be held accountable for it.
Yeah, it's really surprising. And actually, you know, a great book on this is Don Norman's The Design of Everyday Things. Have you ever read that?
I've heard of it. I don't think I have it. I have to track it down.
It's very much about this. It's very much about designing products for people and not requesting people conform to your product. Right. So one of his most simple examples is, you know, we all know how doors work. Why are there so many doors we walk up to that we can't operate correctly? Right. We push instead of pull. We push or pull on the wrong end of it.
Yeah,
you know, there's no visual indicators. You know, why do we have to learn how that door works and memorize every door in our life, which way it works?
That's right.
When in fact, it'd be very simple to have them all, you know, without any kind of training, you know what to do. You know, there's so many doors that have what look like pull handles on doors you should push, right? Right. And it doesn't. Yeah. Or they have a bar across the whole front with no indication what side the hinge is on.
That's right. And round handles don't help either. But the lever handles, they could push or pull. Or the round ones, or push or pull. So there's some designs that don't give you any clues whatsoever. Yeah. But I mean, so let's go back to your plane, right? So how do they, I mean, yeah, they go off and do this investigation, but your buddy was restoring this thing. And I mean, what else did he learn from?
He put a much stronger spar in, by the way, in his restoration. He didn't use the stock one. He put on one that is much stronger. Even though he's not planning to do dogfighting with it, but.
Yeah, and he sells it to somebody, or you get a hold of it and start. Oh, how does this work?
There's no hope if I get a hold of it alone. It doesn't matter how you design it.
That's right. It's that sudden stop routine that you might incur.
Exactly.
But I mean, that's a major overhaul to replace the star. That's like rebuilding it from scratch.
And pretty much.
There's like 15 topics here, Adam. You just kind of threw me a loop here because I thought we were going to talk about restoration of this thing. But this whole concept of design for real people, that is, I mean, in the 40s and 50s, they designed this to teach pilots how to fly, right? And they had as their design specification, and there was probably plenty of folks that were involved that were pilots and had experience and that whole realm. But these products last for a long, long time. And that whole concept of customers are going to use it the way they think it should be used, irregardless of what's in the manual.
Right.
You know, right. That's a huge issue. I think this one, your story about this aircraft is this, it's, you know, 65 years in the past from when it was made, not from when it was designed. So there's not a lot of liability back to the individual people. What if the company would have not been there anymore? It's probably a non-issue kind of thing. But did your friend have to go back to the FAA to get airworthiness certification, or is that matter?
They're very closely involved in the entire restoration recertification process of something like that. They don't, you know, they want to know, is this a Yahoo, you know, or they're having professionals do it. I mean, he managed the restoration. I mean, he's an engineer. He managed a restoration, but he had professionals who were expert in it do the restoration. I mean, he, you know, was there with some of it, but it wasn't like he did it in his garage. He wouldn't be allowed to do that with something like this. Hmm. But so it's right. So it just does. It's, you know, the fact that Beechcraft could be called in the year, you know, post millennia when they designed this thing in World War II. It's really interesting. So yeah, and it's it begs the question, if you are in, you do have a product that can affect people's lives, you know, when does that accountability end? And is there, I don't know if there is any kind of standard for that too, right? I mean, is there precedent that has been set to where you can point to for your industry that, you know, you are not held accountable after this date or, you know, because of this modification or so many people have touched it?
For folks that are listening from the U.S., it's probably clear that we're talking about liability and court cases and getting sued back for damages and things like that. Other parts of the world don't have that, right? It's turned. You buy a product, and if you misuse it, it's on you. It's on – you got to follow instructions. You need to use it in a meaningful with respect to how the design was intended to be. And if you go beyond that too much further and you get hurt, and then that's your own fault. Where the U.S., we've got enough people, I guess there's too high of a percentage of lawyers that say, no, the designer should have foreseen that. And there's classic cases. What was the rear gas engine or gasoline tank there?
Sure. The Ford Pinto and was the one with the gas tank. Yeah.
Right. But it failed in an accident. And so, yeah, it could have been foreseen, you know, cars do get in accidents, all of those kinds of things, but it becomes a gray line really quick in many, many cases. And that's where each one goes. If it gets to court, then it's going to be decided by a jury or negotiations. But yeah, I've heard of all kinds of things where in, I had a client or a potential client, I'm not actually working with them, but they're making a product that has a stand and then there's this glass tube at the top and it's part of how the product works. And when they were setting up the prototype, which was, they were ready to go to production and they wanted, oh yeah, we need to think about reliability. Like, well, it's two strikes against you already kind of thing.
And you can't paint it on. I hate that when people think they can paint on reliability like a coat of paint in the end after it's designed.
They wanted me to do, you know, go do a couple of tests and make sure it passed, and that way they had reliability. I'm like, no. So they set this thing up on the table, and the glass thing wobbled just in its stand. And I said, what happens if that falls over? And it looked expensive. It was kind of like a very fancy chemistry set inside this glass. And they said, oh, it breaks. It's loose. And given the what I knew about the how it was being used, is like, that's going to break. And, and they were right away that one of the guys was adamant that if it breaks, it's the customer's fault. They have to pay for it.
Yeah.
And it was 2/3 the cost of the system. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. you don't have a reliability problem here. You've got an attitude problem.
Right.
You know?
Well, do you want, it's funny, if you want to... if you think that, you know, the 65-year-old plane the day before, and this goes to hashtag bad parenting. I had my girls up in old 1920s biplane and, you know, open cockpit, the whole thing. So when they were younger, I think we used to do models together, and we used to build the models, you know, out of wood with the tissue paper on it, you know, if you know those.
Yeah.
So when we were getting out of the plane, I'm like, do you guys understand that the way we made those models, that's how this made. And I had them touch the wing. I'm like, that's wood. And I'm like, that's canvas. So you can feel it's just canvas on wood, you know? And their eyes opened up because they're so used to this, you know, interaction with airplanes, like on airliners and stuff, where you just, you know, it's just this invisible
cabin. It's another
room.
Yeah, it's another building.
Room, right, exactly. Yeah. And when the look on their eyes, when they all of a sudden really looked at it, what we just had done, and it was wood, canvas and cables that have, like, you know, basically the little clamps holding the cables in place to keep the wings from, you know, breaking off because of all the forces on them. You know, that was fascinating too. And to look at that, where from, take that back even farther for accountability, right? Where at that point, the pilot had to be the mechanic and effectively was entirely accountable, right? Because you were expected by the manufacturer to go around and check that all the cables were still attached, right? Everything's tightened, right? Everything looks correct. And there was really probably no real accountability to the actual manufacturer, I would think, at the 1920s, right? It would be the pilot's fault for not checking the equipment, which is expected to constantly have issues.
Right. Well, I mean, it's tons and tons of cases of that. Good thing it wasn't tissue paper, and you know, they put their foot through it when they got in and out.
Oh, you had to be very careful where you step to get in. There's very specific spots to step because your foot would go right through the it's canvas. Like, you know, like drop cloth. Yeah, it's like drop cloth canvas that's painted, and it's the paint that stops the air from going through.
Oh, wow.
So it was pretty, yeah, it was really cool. It was really fun. They had a blast. If you want, we can put pictures up at the episode on the site. I can give you pictures of both planes.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be cool. But it's one of the other point that comes out of this is, I mean, both planes have been treated well so that they're still airworthy and going. There's plenty of products, though, that are, and Kirk often makes the point that there's products that the electronics work just fine. I think he was arguing the other day that his VCR would still work if he had movies worth watching on it. You know, there's plenty of things that outlive whether it's technologically obsolescence or just its usefulness or its even its expected life. Yet, when does that obligation for its good use and spares and all those other things end? So consumer products often decide that based on economic terms. We're not going to hold a whole suite of spares for the one remaining refrigerator we know is still out there. But aircraft and automobiles, I mean, there's a whole second market for restorations and repairs and spares and all those other things.
Well, some of the planes you fly in airlines, or actually you'd probably be pretty surprised how old some of them are.
Oh,
you
know? No, I'm not surprised.
You kind of look at the seatbelts and you're like, this seatbelt looks like it's been around for a long, long time. Not to mention it's a cool 1970s color, right? You're like,
Well, okay. Yeah. Well,
you know, on like, the, this is a good...
On the Boeing 737s, when you walk in the door, they usually use, well, the front door for getting in and out of it, when they come up to a gate. If you turn around and look up, there's a little placard right there, a little piece of paper like you see in elevators, you know, the little mm-hmm. certificate saying mm-hmm. here's, and it has the tail number and the date it was put into service. And when those 37s were getting older, you know, 20, 25 years old, and like this one's been through a lot of cycles.
Yeah.
You know, it's maintained, it's cared for, it's inspected, yet shortly after Southwest Airlines had a piece of the fuselage rip off because of stress cracking.
Well, there's cracks all throughout it. What they do is they actually, in inspection, measure the cracks, and there's only it's supposed to get so long or come in connection to each other, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's not even that there's no cracks. It's they're looking for the change in, you know, the cracks moving.
You know, that's not helping.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, buddy. But that's the truth, unfortunately, is that there's cracks in life, and they just want to make sure they're not moving. It's crazy. Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, it's a part of it, but we'll have to come back and visit this restoration one, because I think there's more to learn about what works and what doesn't work, and Kirk might be another one to dive in on this stuff. You know, one quick story, I was traveling, and Diane and I were off in Africa, and we're taking a small plane, maybe seated 10, 12 people or something like that, and I have no idea what kind of plane it was. It had some retrofitted toggle switches on the dashboard and some analog little meters that were all in Russian or some Slavic language I couldn't read. And the pilot gets in, and the first thing he does is strap an iPad to his thigh with a little holster kind of thing, so it holds it in place, and he strapped that on. He pulled up a navigation system, and that was how he navigated, was on an iPad.
Wow.
Everything else was, you know, it was not even flying by instruments. I think it had an altimeter, and it had something that showed the level, if the wings were level to the horizon.
Yep.
And that was about it. And then his iPad.
Yep.
You know?
Apple.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, took off, made it work. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Adaptation of new technology.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, yeah, we're going to have to come back to this one, because I think this underlying concept of how do you design it for, it's not even corner cases of people, but for further out, you know, just how people evolve, how they use your product. And it's going to happen.
Well, nobody believes your bathtub curve has a curve at the latter part and it doesn't hold water. Just want to go on forever and ever.
Yeah, you know, and it's not a bad problem to have. You know, Beechcraft has an aircraft that's flying 65 years later, and it's worth restoring. And so that's a testament to the original design and that whole concept. But so anyway, let's wrap it up there. I think it's an interesting couple of concepts in here. We'll have to come back to.
Yeah, I'm glad we got to talk about it.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So if folks want to chime in and join the conversation, as a few of you have already done, and we certainly appreciate the feedback, is head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a form and multiple ways for you to get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. And if you'd like, you can maybe hook up with Adam and go fly in an old aircraft.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, you probably get a whole new attention to reliability when you do that with somebody.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think we sold it very well if that's what we were trying to do, is get people to go up with me.
Yeah, no, that's not going to happen. All right, cool. Thanks, Adam.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.